All right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Horrigan, and welcome to the Medford Public Library for tonight's lecture on the Great Middlesex Tornado, a tornado that if you were standing here and there were no walls, you could have seen go by on the date of August 22nd, 1851.
I'm going to turn off the lights if you don't mind.
Okay. Little background about myself. I'm a folklorist and a historical fire researcher, a historical weather researcher. I've looked at all the great American fires from 1620 in Plymouth Plantation, where smoking was actually banned outdoors. You had to smoke indoors because the embers were going from pipes into the thatch roofs. To the great Boston fires of 1676, 1711, 1760, the Damrell's fire of 1872, and on and on and on. I also study historical weather in New England, beginning with Columbus's foray, his four voyages to the Caribbean. And we're going to look at the first recorded tornado by Anglo-Saxons in America at the conclusion of tonight's lecture. It's called John Winthrop's Sudden Gust. And it's got nothing to do with a gastrointestinal disorder. It's about a tornado. And then I'm also a historical economy researcher. I'm working on a lecture right now that I've given several times. Panics, booms, bust, bubbles, depressions, and recessions, a history of American financial crises. And what I try to tell people about this particular era that we're in right now, it's a correction. It's not a depression. That's the good news. And we're out of a correction, you soar out of that correction. But the bad news is I think we're in about the top of the third inning. We've got a long way to go. I've been called a lot of things, some good, some bad, but an old New England folklorist, a pocket historian, a non-academic storyteller, a rogue nostalgic, an infotainer born from Google Books and PowerPoint. I try to tell people I don't have a prefix before my name or a suffix following my name, nor do I have a mortgage-sized student loan nipping at my heels for the rest of my life. So, I have what's known as the new popular public history. And what I like to do is bring a contemporary and invigorating view to American history. If it weren't for contemporary genealogy, which is all the rage these days, then America would have lost her grasp of her grand heritage altogether. So any genealogists out there, I salute you. I have fascination with early 20th century aviation, so I was surprised when I saw the display here of Amelia Earhart, Medford's own Amelia Earhart. And I also research junk science, paranormal legends, mysteries, and stuff like that. Barbara, I don't know if you heard her mention, but the last time I spoke here was in 2001 when I spoke about the abominable snowman. I am a professional sports announcer with the Boston Bruins alumni and New England Patriots alumni. I'm the Bruins show hockey announcer and the Patriots basketball announcer, if you can believe that. So if I break out into a play-by-play voice, I apologize in advance. I also organized the New England History Festival, which is coming to Watertown on November 14th, not the 15th. I thought that I corrected that. Log on to historyfestival.org. We've got John F. Kennedy doing the Missiles of October, an impersonator. We've got Abigail Adams. My brother's doing the Lady in Black. He's going to dispel that myth. Who else do we have? Colonial Doctor, Harriet Tubman, and the author Diane Rappaport doing the Naked Quaker. A lot of fun. We invite you November 14th. This, that, and the other thing. Cell phones off, please. Usually as soon as I say that, mine goes off. But fire exits out here, take a left, and take a left up the stairs and get away from the building. My numerous websites, just remember www.ushistory.me or johnhorrigan.com. All right, then. Well, first and foremost, we got to get back to 1851. We're trying to get back to August 22nd, 1851. We're going to be looking at the year, etc. So here we go. Buddy of mine, Herbert George Wells, H.G. Wells, said we could borrow his time machine. I just want to let you know a couple of rules. Number one, you'll have to remove your shoes and go through my medical metal detector here. Number two, I'm selling pillows for $5. There are no snacks, and I've just learned that our trip this evening has been delayed by 3 hours. Okay, here we go. My wife has described this part of my lectures as goofy, and so you won't offend me if you think that that's the same part. We're going on the time machine. Here we go. Trying to get back to 1851. Sherman and Mr. Peabody, I may need your help here. Here we go. Here we go. We got there without all the bells and whistles, so there you go. We'll talk about this cat in just a second. So tonight we're going to talk about the Great West Cambridge Tornado. Okay, they've called it the Great Middlesex Tornado. And it happened on August 22nd, 1851. And this town of Medford was devastated. They got the brunt of this tornado. It's the last great eastern Massachusetts tornado. And as you'll see tonight, whereas the Portland Gale destroyed in 1898, destroyed Provincetown and knocked it out as one of the great fishing ports in America, this particular tornado knocks out New England as a great orchard region, as a great cider producer, which is unfortunate. So we're going to look at the accounts, the track of the tornado, something I call apples to apples, the aftermath, the other great Middlesex tornado, the first Anglo-Saxon American tornado, Winthrop sudden gust, water spouts, and then some recent severe thunderstorms in the area. And if you have any great stories, I'm all ears at the end of tonight's lecture. Let's look at the year 1851. January 23rd, the flip of a coin determines whether a new city in the Oregon Territory is named after Boston, Massachusetts, or Portland, Maine. With which city won? Portland. March 27, 1851, the first reported case of Anglo-Saxons seeing Yosemite Valley. People look at the year 1851 as being in the Stone Age. It wasn't. The people were very advanced, but they hadn't expanded westward. June 21st, the Immortal Game was a chess game played by Adolf Anderson and Lionel Kierzewitzki. It's a rivalry similar to the Fischer and Spassky rivalry of the early 1970s. The bold sacrifices made by Anderson to finally secure a victory made it one of the most famous chess games of all time, followed worldwide throughout the press. He gave up both of his rooks and then his queen, and then checkmated his opponent with his three remaining minor pieces. It's been called an achievement perhaps unparalleled in chess literature. And you can see their caricatures down there in the lower right-hand corner. And then on August 22nd, the day of this tornado, the yacht America won the first America's Cup yacht race. Who's the president in 1851? Bueller? Hint, last member of the Whig Party to be elected president. Five down, Soupy. This guy. See, nobody knows. It's Millard Fillmore. Circle gets the square. 13th president of the United States of America. I'm going to talk a little bit about Millard Fillmore in just a moment, but he was a strange cat in the year 1851. How can I say it? Well, let me back up. The man, he took over the office of Zachary Taylor. Taylor died of a stomach disorder eating some bad cherries on the 4th of July celebration of Washington, D.C. And when it came time to swear in the replacement, Millard had been overserved, and I'll leave it at that. We're going to look at the accounts tonight. Reverend Charles Brooks of West Medford. West Medford is now known as what? Westchester? West Haven?
Winchester.
Winchester.
West.
Right. Arlington. Okay. A leader in public education, he wrote the pamphlet Tornado of 1851. So I'm going to be drawing a lot when you hear Reverend Brooks. I'm talking about Reverend Charles Brooks of West Medford. Then William Blasius of Cambridge. He's a scientist without portfolio. Kind of like me, a lecturer without portfolio. He has an extensive study of the track, the destruction, and the meteorological phenomena associated with it. He wrote an article after the tornado called Storms, Their Nature, Classification, and Laws. And I'll also be drawing from the research of Professor Henry L. Eustace of Harvard College. He wrote The Tornado of August 22, 1851. So we have Blasius, Brooks, and Eustace. Charles Sims Parker also wrote something about this tornado when he authored the book Town of Arlington, Past and Present. And then one of my heroes, well, two of them in weather folklore, first is Edward Rowe Snow. Who needs facts when you can tell a great story? And David McWilliams Ludlam, who authored the book Early American Tornadoes. Great author. And then, of course, Sidney Perley with Historic Storms of New England, printed in 1891. I recommend that book highly. So Due to the dense population of the area in which it passed, this was the most closely observed tornado in American history up to that point. Blasius. He's an intellectual who migrated to America after political revolution in Germany in 1848. He was not an accredited professor. And he was fishing at Fresh Pond a few minutes before the tornado passed by, only a few hundred yards away to the north of that small body of water. But he had taken shelter from the approaching thundercloud and did not actually witness the event, much to his chagrin. His lecture in Concord, Mass. In February of 1852, that following winter, was attended by none other than Henry David Thoreau, who was, to put it lightly, a rock star in the 1840s and 50s in Massachusetts. A strange cat, but very popular writer, a naturalist philosopher. He said, quote, and I like this, "The audience are never tired of hearing how far the wind carried some man, woman, or child, or family Bible, but they are immediately tired if you undertake to give them a scientific account of it." So I'll try not to do that tonight. Was it really a tornado? Well, Judge Parmenter, author of Middlesex County History, the late 19th century, said, quote, "Those who saw it described it as a dark cloud sweeping over the surface of the country with frightful speed, its base now touching the earth and now bounding up for a little to return farther on. Its shape was variously compared to a spreading elm and upright column, to an hourglass, and to an inverted cone. There were different vantage points, and they offered diverse descriptions. A witness described it as an elephant's trunk waving from side to side and sucking up everything that came in its way and 30 to 50 rods, a rod is 16 and a half feet, in some areas of swath of devastation." So you're looking at almost 900 feet in width at its widest part. And I will give you a moving GIF alert. There will be silly moving GIFs throughout my presentation tonight. I hearken back to the term goofy that my wife used. The calm before the storm. Well, a hot, sultry day on Friday, August 22nd, 1851, as a light southwest wind had been blowing for most of the day. But it died away as the dark bank of clouds moved in at 4:30 in the afternoon, and there was a perfect calm at that time. Reverend Brooks, quote, "Peculiar, many spoke of a dead closeness, a remarkable want of elasticity in the air. Many complained of lassitude," that's weariness, "from this cause." So it was a lazy late August day. William Blasius, quote, "The air was calm, sultry, and oppressive. Not the slightest breeze was blowing, not a leaf moving. A death-like stillness prevailed around us in nature." So everybody said it was an eerily calm day. And anybody from the Midwest will tell you that that's usually the precursor to some really severe weather. Clouds grew up on the western horizon and nearly reached the zenith, so an enormous thunderhead forms. 4 o'clock, an old sea captain told his wife, "If I was at sea, I should expect to see a waterspout." The temperatures measured between 75 degrees Fahrenheit and 80 degrees Fahrenheit, and mid-afternoon showed a falling barometer, fair skies, and a southwesterly wind flow. David Ludlam, in his book, said that there was a stagnant air mass of moisture-laden tropical air over southern New England with cool polar air, that's a cold front, moving southward over Vermont and New Hampshire. So you have a severe front moving south, colliding with a warm front. So the central line of march seemed to be west-southwest to east-southeast of this tornado. Topography. Well, it tracked through woods and plains, hills and valleys, villages and cultivated fields. Aside from homes, fences and chimneys were destroyed, and some trees were flattened, whereas adjacent trees remained unscathed. And you know about that phenomenon of tornadoes where a neighbor's house can get taken out and somebody right next door, no damage. Well, some cornfields looked as though they had been rolled over by a heavy press. The axis line lay between north 60 east and north 70 east, and it was measured and staked every 100 feet during a post-storm survey by Eustis. And we're going to take a look at that map. Essentially, it followed modern-day Route 60 and a little bit of Route 20 on the way into Route 60. Well, what happened to the tornado? It began in Quinsigamond, Worcester. Then it moved to Wayland, Weston, Waltham, Belmont, West Cambridge, which is Arlington, Medford, Malden, Lynn, Swampscott, Rockport, and did the thing blow out to sea, and we'll look at that later on. The breath of the monster. At Mystic River, it was 71 rods wide. we said, what did we say, 16 and a half feet for a rod? So you're almost, near 1,000 feet. At the Lowell Railroad Depot, 60 rods wide. Mrs. Porter's house, we'll get to that in a second, 56 rods wide. Miss Brooks' house, 54 rods wide. Dr. Kidder's house in the Andover Turnpike, 54 rods wide. Mr. Swan's and Mr. Hall's land, 53 rods wide. And only 6 yards wide at its conception in Waltham. It was about 20 to 40 yards wide in Medford at its terminus, but it was very intense, very severe when it came through this town. And oh, the lightning. The lightning was vivid and fierce. There was a report of a melted lightning rod in West Medford and several other charred lightning rods along the tornado's course. What I call the course of the buzzsaw. It hit the premises of James Brown on the Waltham line and swept across it, ripping up orchards, woods, and cornfields. It traversed Pleasant Street to the Belmont line and tore across the land of Captain Hopkins, Dr. Wellington, and other residents on the eastern side of the street. It then raced across the northeast corner of Spy Pond, demolishing ice houses on the water's edge, crossing the highway near Franklin Street, destroying a store, a schoolhouse, and dwellings. It then zigzagged through Arlington and hit the Lowell Railroad Depot, then crossed the Mystic River about 50 rods below Ware Bridge in Medford. Does anybody know where Ware Bridge is?
I think that's the main bridge across the Mystic at 60 still.
Yes.
Same location.
So here's the path. We'll just take a quick look. We're going to be referring to that. So basically west-southwest and east-southeast. It came, it originated in Worcester. But it really defined itself once it got over Prospect Hill at touchdown. And you can see the direction that it moves through.
Right through Bedford Center, right?
All the way through Walden. And again, there are reports that it actually touched down in, off of Rockport. So we're going to look at Henry Eustace's map here. And my good friend Wayne McCarthy, the president of the Waltham Historical Society, provided me with this information. This map was published 4 years after the tornado, 1855, and it covers the track from Wellington Hill to the Mystic River. It was born in Worcester. It began in Quinsigamond Village, eastern Worcester, about 27 miles west of Waltham, sometime around 4:30 in the afternoon. Crops were flattened, roofs torn off, and trees uprooted. Many felt an odd stillness in the air just prior to the blast of the angry zephyr. The wailing and wailand. Alliteration. Severe showers and then an extraordinary flash of lightning came. Residents thought that a building had been struck as a very dark cloud described as a dense black column of what appeared to be smoke rose very rapidly, 1 mile in height. This was no smoke. It looked like an inverted elm or hourglass. Quote, the heavens sparked. So we're in Waltham. And it came off of Prospect Hill. A long roll of thunder came just after 2 o'clock in the afternoon from the northwest. A very black bank of clouds rose to the height of 50 degrees, stretching from west-southwest to east-northeast. The first full force of the whirlwind struck at Prospect Hill, a 482-foot eminence east of modern-day Route 128 and north of the Route 20 interchange with Route 117. Quote, emerging from a thicket of forest growth near the foot of Wellington Hill, which is Lexington and Bacon Streets in Waltham, the storm crosses an open meadow and commences the ascent of the hill. Then it passes along the crest of the hill, meeting in its way houses and barns, orchards, cornfields, fences, and forests. That's a view of Boston from Prospect Hill. So it came from the hill with an attitude, and you're going to see these as we hit this map here. That's the wind direction. Okay, so right now you can see there is a, not really cyclonic, a couple of aberrations here with the direction of wind, but it's blowing at this point to the northwest. The wind whipped up as it came across Wellington Hill and Trapello Road. And you can see the circles and the wind direction intensifying. A dozen wind directions on 1 acre of land at the base of Prospect Hill. So here it is. It's getting organized. The funnel cloud is certainly getting organized here. You can see a variety of wind directions. And again, this was measured by Eustace, and he determined this by the vegetation and trees and the directions they were lying on the ground and where they were broken off, whether it was at the base or midway through their stems. There were assorted losses in Waltham. The buildings of Robert Baldwin and Sons was badly damaged as a portion of the roofs of both house and barn were carried away with two or three sheds. Several hives of bees were destroyed along with their honey. The bees themselves took immediate possession of the elder Mr. Baldwin's house, whose residents were compelled to beat a retreat. The Baldwins lost many valuable fruit trees with other crops. Their loss is estimated at not less than $1,000. And again, you're going to look at $1,851. And I'll have to go online to give you the exact translation of $2,009. The dwelling house of Mr. Nathan Lawrence was partly unroofed, and the shed attached to it was turned around. A part of the roof of Mr. Lawrence's new barn was carried away, and the backside was blown out. Mr. Lawrence lost nearly all his fruit trees. His loss may be estimated at about $500. Mr. Sullivan Wellington, tenant to Mr. Lawrence, lost a quantity of hay blown out of the barn. Also a lot of salt hay, which lay in heaps in the field, with the whole of his fruit crop estimated at about $200. Mr. Sawyer had two sheds carried away, with considerable other damage estimated at $300. So the total in Waltham, $4,000 of $1,851. By the time the thing left Waltham, there was considerable damage to orchards and other trees. Fruit and crops were lost as far as North Street, and Mr. Sawyer had two of his sheds carried away. The tornado then pursued a course across a rock meadow and slammed into the Kendall estate. Waltham would, as I mentioned, sustain $4,000 worth of damages. So it moved just north of Beaver Brook Reservation and crossed at the junction of Route 2 and Pleasant Street. Quote, this is Eustace. Now it commences its descent and, as if gathering fresh strength at each obstacle, flies with resistless violence throughout the town beneath, Belmont, bathes its weary wings in the waters of Spy Pond, cools its feverish breath by the demolition of an ice house, and with renewed vigor speeds its way through the heart of West Cambridge over the plain to the Mystic River. Was there a Spy Pond waterspout? Was this a waterspout? Technically, when a tornado passes over a body of water and the composition over 50% of it contains water, it can be classified as a waterspout. Normally, waterspouts, of course, are seen out in salt water or in the Great Lakes. As the vortex crossed Spy Pond, a column of water more than 100 feet high, mixed with dust from the roadway and gravel from the railroad embankment, was raised from the surface, and two ice houses on the shore were demolished. In one of the ice houses was a man with a horse and a carriage. As the storm began, the horse panicked and started out of the building, dragging the man. As it did, the carriage was crushed by falling timbers. The horse and the man, though, were uninjured. Colonel Douglas seems to be a bit of a braggart from what I can tell. Colonel Douglas of Cambridgeport, who was sailing on the pond with two friends, had his boat lifted into the air perpendicularly by the spout, but saved his life by clinging to a tree on the nearby shore. And nowhere could I find what happened to his buddies. Quote, this is Blasius now, this is beautiful. Everything in the vicinity, including several boys playing on the shore, were plastered in mud and water and a gravelly mud. The boys, uninjured, in their fleeting elation, asked if it might happen again just one more time. Here's an image of an ice harvest. Spy Pond was known for producing a lot of ice. 1854. So now on to Arlington, West Cambridge. Ripping it up at Brown's Orchard. West Cambridge, Brown's Farm, $850 worth of damage at Brown's Orchard. Brown's Farm, the tenant by the name of Fogg, sustained $250 worth of damage. The man who was renting that from him. You can see the up in the right hand. I don't know.
Did we lose the focus here, folks? I don't have my glasses on. Did that just make it worse?
It was good before, is what you're saying. Why did you have to go and do that? West Cambridge, William Hill's farm, $750 worth of damage. The southerly side of the trees and wall were caked in mud. So there was a pronounced direction of the wind flow. West Cambridge, Thaddeus Frost's farm, $440 worth of pear and apple trees and a cucumber patch. Daniel Hill Family Farm, $500 worth of damage, including a watermelon patch. Again, you can see the wind direction. Timothy Swan lost 75 apple trees, 8 peach trees, 5 cherry trees, and 2 pear trees, and the partridges in them. $940. Fessenden and Whittemore's large grocery and dry goods store was leveled. Gershom Whittemore, the proprietor, was in the store at the time of the tornado. He was buried in the ruins. He arose dazed and cut and bruised. And overall, the Fessenden and Whittemore families lost $3,452.50. In the middle of Mr. Henry Whittemore's house in West Cambridge, in the second story, there's a door in whose top are 6 small panes of glass. This door is exactly opposite the front window, which was blown in during the tornado. Before the 6 panes of glass hung a white cloth curtain. Through this curtain was perforated a small, ragged hole not larger than a pea. Directly behind this hole, the panel of glass is perforated, and a hole is left almost as large as a half dollar. This hole in the glass was nearly round, and its edges, instead of being sharp as broken glass is, seemed melted into roundness. Moreover, for a quarter of an inch around the edges of this hole, there's a thin, wavy layer of apparently melted glass. A few cracks in the glass ray off from the center of the hole. Since the tornado, a piece of glass, which was loose, has been taken out, thus destroying, so far, the circular form of the hole and the wavy layers which bounded it, Reverend Brooks. And we all know that projectiles, tornadoes, there's a fusillade of missiles. Anything can be turned into a missile. John Fowle lost his store and $1,100. The damage to the center schoolhouse was only $124. I think that was a fence and some roofing. And boy, it worked over Arlington. Oaks, maples, walnuts from 2 to 2.5 feet in diameter were snapped like straws. And it's unfortunate, but most of these trees were around during the days of Cotton Mather pre-revolution. It passed through Arlington from west-southwest to east-northeast, causing $23,606 worth of damages. It then crossed Alewife Brook at Tufts. And as it moved towards Medford, the cyclone intensified. Here we are in Medford now. Again, I'm not from the town, but do we have any lifers here or any longtime residents here in Medford?
The map that you were just showing where it showed what's now Mass Ave, and it was Charlestown Road, I believe that's Broadway, so that's the fork right in downtown Arlington Center where the firehouse is.
Okay, wow. So
with, just as you said, following along the bottom of the escarpment right along today's Route 60.
Wow, wow. Yeah, it's here and then 16. My GPS from Watertown sent me into New Hampshire. It wanted to send me to get here today. It's just I could have just jumped on 60. It's and the menace cometh. As it crossed the Meeting House Brook and then the Andover Turnpike, old Route 28, and now part of I-93, the vortex exhibited a power in the elements never witnessed by the oldest inhabitants of this region. And this is the famous depiction that showed up, the artist's rendering that showed up in Gleason's pictorial less than a month after the tornado, September 13th, 1851. And I think it just, you can just see the not only the sky, but the fury. And I think we've been through what's known as microbursts. Everybody's experienced that, where you have these intense wind, where you're underneath a nasty cell. But it just, it gives, and look at this poor Joe, huh? He's clinging for his life. There's another blow up of it. But it's just right down the main street. Here's another rendering of horrors of the world when throughout New England. Just another depiction. You can see people pinned. A poor child lying here lifeless, although the child did not die. And I know I had to say Method. I'm sorry. The menace of Method. Is that how you say it? How would you spell it? I had that and I changed it. Method. Evidence that the funnel lifted and skipped at times as only tops of roofs and trees displayed damage. Some insist that there was no time to react as the whirlwind traveled over 50 miles per hour. The only death occurred here in Medford. And in West Medford, a part of the roof of Mr. Lane's barn and several feet of lead pipe from Reverend Pierpont's house were carried more than 500 feet directly across its track. and many trees and other objects apparently in the midst of the current were left untouched, while others on its extreme verge were swept away. The Medford blowout. The track of the wind here went from 40 to 76 rods wide, a rod being 16 and a half feet. It caused $18,768 in damage in Medford. And it passed through the northern part of Medford near the railroad depot, demolishing several houses, barns, and other buildings. A two-story brick building was destroyed. Mr. West moves northwest. Mr. West, building a house for Mr. Haskins in Medford, started coming from West Cambridge. As soon as he saw it destroy a house adjacent to the Lowell Railroad Depot, he sprang from the house and ran for his life, hiding behind a wall only 5 rods distant. When he did, the house behind him was destroyed. Both houses were destroyed in 5 or 6 seconds. And Reverend Brooks thinks that this is the end of the world. Quote, I was in my sister's house at the time, saw it but an instant before it struck the house. I rushed to lock the front door, and at that moment we felt the first shock. I cried out violently to the family that it was all over. Good to have him around in a crisis, huh, Reverend? I opened the door and sprang upon the bank over which its center had just passed and looked for it. It had gone at least a mile before I could reach the place, though the distance from the house was not 3 rods. It seemed to me but a breath of time, and now after reviewing the facts, I cannot persuade myself that its speed at that place was less than 50 miles per hour. The thing was moving. Miss Brooks' place got walloped. One witness says she saw the large barn owned by Miss Brooks rise in the air and then fall in ruins. There is evidence yet remaining that this large barn, built of heavy timber and plank, was taken up and then carried 15 feet before it was torn to pieces. Brooks. Where'd the roof go? The roof of Miss Brooks' house was seen to go thus, and although every beam and rafter went with it, we have not yet been able to find even a shingle of it, though we have searched thorough 3 miles. Just a note, the Worcester tornado of June 9, 1953, the Worcester Telegram, copies of it were found in Boston Harbor and on Blue Hills Observatory in Milton. There goes the tree. A tree of very large size in Miss Brooks' orchard was decapitated, and the trunk now stands erect. But the top was taken up and carried off and has never been found. And there goes another one in Miss Brooks' garden. The trees, to the number of 50 or more, lie oddly. A locust tree, 9 1/4 rods from center, points northwest, while a cherry tree that lies upon it points south-southeast. 1 rod south of center, a cherry tree points northeast by east. Fusillade of missiles. Shingles and boards and rafters and slates, which are known to have belonged to certain houses, were found 2 or 3 miles from their original places. My favorite title. Boy, did Doc Kinner get it, but good. A thick, strong brick wall was thrown down 10 feet from its foundation. Some of the bricks carried to a great distance. A pine tree, 10 inches in diameter, was broken off and carried some 100 feet into the air and then thrown through the roof and window of Dr. Kidder's house. His lightning rods were much bent, according to Reverend Brooks. How'd you like them apples? Near Mystic River and Ware Bridge, a field of 75 acres stand apple trees unmoved and uninjured, while all their nearest neighbors lie prostrate and broken. There were many who thought that the apples lying upon the ground at the time were baked on their south side by the heat and the wind. That most apples so situated among us were found so baked is true, but whether the sun had not previously done this, according to his usual action in a midsummer drought, is what we leave others to decide. No one who was in the wind felt any baking heat during its passage. 1849 to 1851 in New England was a severe weather year. In October of 1849, the starvation famine ship, the wreck of the St. John, happened off the coast of Cohasset in the Glades. It had a tremendous October gale, October 7th, 1849. And then in 1851, just prior to this tornado, in April, a tremendous nor'easter hit and knocked down the first Minot's Lighthouse off the coast of Cohasset, killing the two light assistant lightkeepers. So it was a really bad year, a bad set of years from 1849 to 1851, and I could argue into 1852, where New England was just hit with bad snowstorms, tornadoes, hurricanes, or nor'easters. In Mr. Hastings' orchard, south of his house, on the banks of the Mystic River, stood a large old apple tree. This tree was 74 and a half rods south-southeast of what seemed to be the outer southern edge of the tornado. Nevertheless, it was beheaded, split, and lies pointing exactly east. 100 trees in its immediate vicinity were equally exposed, yet remain untouched. A large horse chestnut tree near the brook in Mr. Usher's land was decapitated, leaving only a few small limbs attached to the lower part of the trunk. Within a week after the tornado, the buds in these limbs began to swell, new leaves soon appeared, and then blossoms. So that on the 16th of September, 25 days after its decapitation, it displayed 10 or 12 full-grown blossoms. In the hurricane in 1938, you hear of cases where apple trees are blown over, and then as the hurricane passes over, they're blown upright, and they bear fruit for the next decade. The flying boxcar. A freight car, which was standing upon the side track of the Lowell Railroad near the depot, was driven upon that track 165 feet and then taken up and carried 60 feet east, nearly at right angles to the track. Except a locomotive and a train. Ware Bridge, and I apologize for this dreadful font. It crossed the Mystic River 50 rods south of Ware Bridge, a high wooden bridge crossing the Middlesex Canal. It was exposed apparently to the full sweep of the gust, but not moved or damaged. More wonderful yet, at the side of this bridge was a small wooden bathhouse, so light that three men might carry it away, and so frail that one might think that a Chinese fan applied with energy might blow it over. This building stands untouched, though nearer the center than is the bridge. So again, these anomalies you have where there's no wind whatsoever. Anybody know what this is? A drawing. This was sketched on the script of a famous movie made in 1939. Can you name the movie? Wizard of Oz. I do believe it's a movie. The roof of Mr. Sanford's shed at the Lowell Railroad Depot, though a few feet north of the center, was thrown 25 or 30 feet northeast and rested at the foot of a tree which pointed east by south. The slates from this roof were separated from it probably while at its greatest elevation, and at that moment, being near the center, they were broken and carried as destructive missiles in every direction. I found some of them a mile distance from their starting point. That's Professor Eustace. Assorted losses in West Medford. Total losses, $18,768. The Medford Schoolhouse fence. Many fruit and ornamental trees, hay, carriages, wagons, houses, furniture, fences. The biggest loser, Charles Rollins, lost two large unfinished houses worth $5,770. Ironically, those houses are probably worth that today. The only incentive. The late Jonathan Brooks lost $1,632. Samuel Teal Jr. lost $1,181. And the Boston Lowell Railroad lost a freight car. And then there's that wig again. In a small room, just four rods south of Medford Center, was an engraved likeness of President Fillmore pasted strongly upon a rough plastered wall. Around it were many other engravings of like size. This room was so situated that the wind came in at a west door and went out at an east window. Well, the wind selected His Excellency's head, took it from the wall without tearing it or soiling it in the least, and having carried it through an open window and transported it more than a quarter of a mile. It was deposited in the garden of a friend who returned it safely to be again fastened in its original place. The casualties of Medford, 7 people were injured. Thomas Huffmaster, a German farmer, lost his life while occupied in closing his house against the storm. He was struck by part of the roof of a neighbor's barn on his head, which was driven through the side of his house. He was taken up insensible and so continued till his death about 30 hours later. James S. Sanford, 18-year-old son of the depot master of the Lowell Railroad, lost both of his feet. The house in which he lived was dislodged from its foundation, and as he was leaving the barn, moving towards the house, he was thrown down and the building came crashing down on his feet. Here's the Wizard of Oz reference. He lay under the timbers for 3/4 of an hour. They were both found so badly crushed as to require amputation, one above the knee and the other just above the ankle, which was successfully performed the same evening at Mass General, and he recovered. A person in the employment of James M. Usher had his arm broken. A stranger was badly injured in the head by the falling limb of a tree, but he recovered. Mrs. Nutter, wife of H.T. Nutter, was at the time confined by illness to her chamber. In an instant, the roof and most of the house was carried away, including the ceiling and two sides of the room she occupied, leaving her entirely unsheltered. The bedstead on which she was lying was torn apart and a beam fell on it, yet she escaped with only a very slight injury. A man and a horse, and again some of this is folklore, were lifted, whirled around, and then set down about 100 yards away. A mechanic at work in the attic of the unfinished building, which was wholly demolished, fell with the house but received only a slight cut on the head. A Mrs. Caldwell, standing in her doorway in her house on a hill, was carried aloft over the tops of trees and deposited safely by the side of a neighbor's barn 500 feet away, suffered only minor bruises, and, quote, such was the suddenness of the force and motion that she can give but an imperfect account of her aerial excursion. The three most seriously hurt were taken at once by the Lowell Railroad to the Massachusetts General Hospital, where they not only had the benefit of the best professional skill in the country, but received attentions and comforts without charge. How's that for your national health care, huh? A stone wall 3.5 feet tall was leveled to the ground. The stones were scattered a rod or two on each side. Luke Costello had his shoulder injured by one of these flying stones. George Maxwell was hit in the head and had his skull fractured. Timothy Fagan's house was unroofed, his wife's ribs badly jammed by her body being crowded into an opening in one side of the house. Again, another folklore here. A woman was sitting with a child in her lap when the house shook and the roof popped off, exposing the sky. She was hit by a falling beam and her infant was only slightly injured in the neck. Death of a cyclone. It lifted in northern Malden, separated into two masses halfway between the earth and the cloud above. The upper part dissipated, and the lower half, in a regular mass, soon disappeared. The heavy wind continued as the microburst now veered north. In Lynn, at a place called Wood End, a boat was blown out of a pond. A large brush heap carried several rods, and apple trees, 8 inches or 10 inches in diameter, were ripped up. As it hit Swampscott, it made a terrific noise, uprooted several trees, moved a house off its foundation, ripped a porch off a house, and scattered pots and kettles. At Rockport, it knocked down trees and forced the tide in to a considerable height. And I'm saying, is this storm surge? And damaged many stores and property. I think what happened here is it was during high tide, and the wind acting with the high tide gave a bit of a flood effect. The aftermath. I could scarcely believe my eyes. Large orchards were completely destroyed. Oaks and maple trees 2 and 2.5 feet in diameter broke. Others twisted like rope at an angle of 180 degrees or more. Still others uprooted and carried in a mutilated state 40 or 50 paces distant. A great number of houses in West Cambridge and Medford were unroofed and the debris carried 50 to 100 paces away. William Blasius. Things were taken up into the air and not beaten down. Trees generally resisted the disintegration caused by the winds, but buildings were racked or shattered. A cornfield in Medford revealed the motion of two separate cyclonic circles of wind, one clockwise, the other counterclockwise, almost playing into each other like cogwheels. Thousands came the following days to Gawkin, of course to Luke. So that again, once again, is the direction of the tornado. The other great Middlesex tornado, people forget about it. It was 20 years later, almost to the day. August 28th, 1871, a Sunday night. These are the dangerous tornadoes. And again, being an old colonial boy of the Atlantic, I've never experienced a tornado, but I can only imagine the terror of people in the Southeast, Texas, and in the Midwest who have to go through nighttime tornadoes. There's no possible way to react to it. Well, Arlington took the brunt of it. Judge Parmenter, again, he was involved in the 1851 tornado, lost his windows at his house on Russell Street. The spire of the Orthodox Congregational Church on Pleasant Street was blown down, turning end over end. Only the vane was damaged and the bell was found intact 20 feet from the spire. Wind began blowing continuously from the southwest at sunset. As the Unitarian Church struck its bell at 11 o'clock, it was blown off into the street. A noble elm that grew during two centuries near the Adams homestead in Arlington, unfortunately, was lost. Back to that Winthrop sudden gust. This is the first recorded tornado by an Anglo-Saxon. It happened on July 15th, 1643. That's the new style of calendar. You have the Julian calendar and then the Gregorian calendar. Pope Gregory corrected the calendar to line it up with religious holidays. If anybody ever tells you the dates September 3rd through September 12th, 1752, they're lying because those dates were removed from the calendar. It went, I think, from September 2nd to September 13th, 1752. Anyways, here's what the four-term governor, John Winthrop of Massachusetts, reigned from 1630 to 1649. Quote, "There arose a sudden gust at northwest, so violent for half an hour, as it blew down multitudes of trees. It lifted up their meeting house at Newbury, with the people being in it. It darkened the air with dust, yet through God's great mercy it did no hurt, but only killed one Indian." So no one got hurt, but an Indian died with the fall of a tree. "It was straight between Lynn and Hampton." So again, Lynn's involved with this. What about waterspouts? Eyewitnesses said that across Spy Pond is a waterspout. Another eyewitness said across Alewife Brook near Tufts University. And just before it slammed into Medford Center, it scaled the Mystic River, and two men were blown completely across the river. Many insisted that it lifted when it blew out to sea after it crossed the Linway at the Saugus River. Other things concerning freshwater waterspouts. Inland waterspouts have been observed over Lake Tahoe, the Great Salt Lake, and Peru's Lake Titicaca. Waterspouts occur most frequently in the Great Lakes during the months of August, September, and October when the lake waters are near their annual maximum temperature. Great Lakes waterspout formation typically occurs when cold Arctic air moving across the waters, setting up a large temperature difference between the warm surface water layer and the overriding cold air. And these spouts tend to last from about 2 to 20 minutes and move along at speeds of 18 to 28 kilometers per hour or 11 to 17 miles per hour. This is one from Lake Huron, 1999, a double waterspout. And the Florida Keys spawned the most saltwater waterspouts in the world. Now, something I'm going to be talking about briefly at the New England History Festival is the 1896 Martha's Vineyard waterspout. Three historic photographs were taken of this in 1896. It happened on August 19th, 1896, in Vineyard Sound. Another one taken from Oak Bluffs. It formed from a thunderstorm on the junction of Vineyard and Nantucket Sounds and moved from Oak Bluffs towards Vineyard Haven. The funnel cloud formed and dissolved three times, though an invisible vortex still raised spray. The funnel cloud was largest on its second appearance when it was vertical. It formed a pillar 3,600 feet high. At the cloud base, it was 840 feet wide. In the middle, 144 feet wide. And at sea level, 240 feet wide. The cascade was 720 feet wide. That's the diameter of the actual vortex. These were all estimates, of course. The spray rose to 420 feet. Just some other ones. This happened in Newton near my house, June 27th, 2008. Microburst uprooted in a tree. The violent, intense thunderstorms, etc., etc. Multiple lightning strikes were reported. Heavy wind gusts, 57 miles per hour on Harvard Bridge. Power was lost to 20,000. Pea-sized hail. Now, we really didn't have that much, well, not in Watertown where I live, of a thunderstorm season. In fact, tornadoes overall in the continental United States were down significantly this year. And that's just the radar screen. Whenever you see purple, hail was reported Medway, Woburn, Wellesley, Arlington, Cambridge, Somerville, Belmont. You probably got some here. on July 2nd, 2008. A three-alarm blaze on Broadway in Arlington. Check this out. And this is June 24, 2008. The hail on the ground in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Check that out. That was just amazing. Again, another one. My buddy who took this photo was just down the street. Said they had to rescue that person who owns that car. Mothball-sized pellets of hail piled up 6 inches deep that day in Pawtucket. A wave of water gushed down from the hill from Park Place, uplifting several parked cars and causing a 7-foot pile of hail and snowy slush to accumulate. Elisa Caraballo said that he and his wife and two children had come to East Avenue to shop for furniture at the Adams Furniture Store. Instead, he ended up borrowing a snow shovel to help a young woman whose car was stuck. Jose Montero, a customer at the Simplicity Salon on East Avenue, had come outside with others to survey the unusual scene. He described 3 to 4 foot waves that came down East Avenue. I saw a man trying to ride his bike who was all cut up from trying to make it through, he stated. And that is my lecture for tonight. I want to thank you all for coming out here. You've been a great audience, and I appreciate you putting up with my moving gifs and silly titles. So thank you very much. Now, I want to take some of your stories. First, I want to recognize, as I mentioned previously, the Worcester tornado. June 29th, 1953, touchdown about 3:30 p.m., depends upon who you talk to. Moving eastward, 46 miles, it moved in 80 minutes and nearly killed 100 and injured nearly 1,400 people. That was in 1953. And who's to say that it couldn't happen again? Does anybody have, has anybody experienced a tornado, first of all? Oh, wonderful. Could you tell me about it, please?
It wasn't that great.
I'm from Michigan.
Okay.
And in 1977, it was April 2nd, my family and I were in an RV on our way to Florida for vacation, and a tornado came across the field. It was an F4.
Wow.
And leveled the RV and rolled over the VW bug behind us.
You're driving. I think the memories as well. How old were you, may
I
ask?
I was nine.
Wow. Now, it just happened. Bang. No one saw it coming, obviously.
No, actually, that's not true. We did see it coming because the field was wide open to I'm remembering it on my left. So the field was wide open. We could see it coming over the field. We were right behind a semi-truck, and my dad thought that if he got in the wake of the truck, that maybe we could be pulled out. Much the way that bikers ride close behind each other. So he decided not to stop right away, even though my mom, we were all seeing it coming at us. So we actually didn't get out and get in the ditch. And it's kind of interesting because the way she tells it now, my mother tells the story, that's actually what saved us because the flooding was so bad in the ditch. The ditch was pretty deep and the flooding was pretty bad. But what happened is we were blown, out of the RV when it exploded. And landed in scattered places, so no one was actually down in the water.
Wow.
It sounds really amazing, and I understand why you're all oohing and aahing, but I have to say, as someone who experienced it, it happens like this, and then you kind of go into shock. Hey, I know you guys. and so, the memories of it to me are like, you get up and you walk away, and you look at your junk all piled up and wet and useless, and you're kind of like, dumbfounded, and then you're really glad you all lived, right? And then you have a great story.
Wow, great story. Anybody else? I know you can't top that. I'll take a microburst. I'll take a gust of wind blowing leaves. Yes.
So about 3 years ago, there was a microburst here. Went through South Bedford and Somerville, and I had a 2.5-foot diameter tree in my backyard that was split off right near the ground. I wasn't home at the time, but my neighbor came running out. He's like, "Oh, I saw it all, and I caught it on my video camera." And so he brings out the video camera, and you can see sort of this tree swaying back and forth, back and forth. And all of a sudden, the picture goes blank.
Yeah.
And you just hear him on the recording. Holy shit. Holy shit. Oh my God. And he was so scared, he dropped the camera. And that was at the moment that the tree split off and fell down. And then he picked up the camera and you can see that no longer a tree there.
Wow.
And there were a number of trees in by the Powder House Rotary in the park there that were knocked down, and a number of other ones in the neighborhood that trees fell on, houses and stuff like that. In my backyard, luckily, it only knocked down the fence and fell between the houses.
Wow. And microbursts, they live short, violent lives, but they can happen anywhere, and even in a metropolitan area. And they're random. You can't really decide. If you were talking about open fields here, that gives a good racetrack for a tornado to run on. They're more likely to touch down on flat surfaces, but history has shown they can drop down into an urban area. All they need is, like you said, the rotary. That's a good one to touch down and cause havoc.
There's sort of this little line that, you know, maybe a half mile, number of trees and number of houses.
The hurricane, was Danny the one that we just missed here? Was that the one that brought the rain? And yeah. My dad in Marshfield said, look it, I want to show you something. And he showed me, there's his house and there's a yard and there's trees down. He says, that thing went through there out there in the tropical storm. There were trees knocked down. It looked like a microburst. And it lasted about 200 yards I could measure. He said, I never heard it, but you can tell something went through there. So, does anybody else have any other? Yes.
Well, I have a question.
Yes.
A couple of microbursts. Clearly, that literally followed at the foot of the escarpment. I mean, right at the foot of the escarpment from Prospect Hill through Waltham, through
Arlington,
through Belmont, and through Medford. And then, you know, as you get to the coastal plain where the escarpment has been smooshed, then, you know, eased out to the sea. So is that a likely effect? In other words, the pressure is dumping off the side of the escarpment and causing the conflict to be more intense between the two fronts?
It's a very good question. I'm going to take that for a called strike because I don't have the answer for that. But
there's a number of tornadoes that follow a fairly similar path because there's a route across the top of Horn Pond. I saw a quickie there. Sometimes you have these little dust devils that if there wasn't something carried, you never would have known it was there.
Right.
In this instance, it was $100 out of a cash box at an event we were having.
Really?
Off to North Medford somewhere. But a few months later, I was reading the history of Woburn, and they had one that came the exact same path over the ridge, of Lexington and Arlington. And
the topography and the terrain, would they follow that? I would say yes, absolutely. This corridor here. I know, not to harp on Watertown, but I'm in an area where there are hills on both sides of my house, and I swear that we're in the valley where the rage of the thunderstorms come right over our head. My dad insists that the North River in Marshfield and in Humrock will cut storms, and storms will tend to stay to the north of that. My wife insists the Charles River is a line of demarcation for weather events.
In your story, it intensified just as it came past Arlington Center, so that would make sense because the Mystic Valley is in fact the ancient Merrimack River Valley. It's a very sharp, pointed valley going north-south, so you'd be coming along the escarpment and then suddenly you're in this north-south
valley
section where you could really pick up some juice. That right after that is my house.
Wow.
Of summers ago, I was right along the river where the playground is between Harvard Ave and High Street, and I saw what was positively a microburst because I could see the leaves in it, and I was right under it. I mean, it was doing this, just like water pouring down. And it was very short. I don't think it was 90 miles an hour. I think it was 45 to 50 miles an hour, but it was interesting. And last spring, we had a burst come through that took a big street tree down in front of my neighbor's house, and I wasn't watching it, so I won't swear that it did a classic microburst,
right,
but it definitely went from zero to 50 maybe.
Yeah.
In a very few minutes, and then was gone.
Wow.
And if it did have any kind of spin or something, that would have helped pull the tree. So I think we probably are in the Tornado Alley.
Yeah, I was going to say that that's some severe weather. You definitely get it when it moves from the east. Does anybody ever feel in the summer storms, I don't know if you have arthritis or I my elbow, my wife can feel storms coming, and she'll know hours before they hit. But there are some people that actually feel it, the drop in barometric pressure, that there's a storm coming. Did you have a question?
Oh, I was just going to say the severe weather. I remember the 1938 hurricane. You know, that was before you ever got any warnings, and nobody knew what it was all about.
Oh, they had warnings. What happened was a rookie named Charles Pierce, 28 years old, in for a vacationing meteorologist, says, you know something? This Caribbean hurricane, there's two high pressures creating a blow. It's going to go right northeast, and he was voted down, the head meteorologist. I've been here. Hurricane will never strike New England in my lifetime. Well, that went 67 miles per hour, that hurricane. It was off the coast of Cape Hatteras in the morning. It hit New York at 3:30. My favorite story is a man went to the post office. He lived on Long Island. Because he got this brand new barometer, it was broken, it was reading 28. And while he was at the post office, his house was blown away. Another chicken farmer on Long Island, one of his chickens was found banded in Connecticut. The people in Connecticut insist that the bug population from Long Island was brought over there during the 1938 hurricane. Catherine Hepburn was waiting to hear if she got a part in what movie?
Gone with the Wind,
that's correct. And shot her best round of golf ever, 9 holes of golf, had a hole in one, shot par for the course. You know, in those days, the people that had the liquor, her boyfriend, Red. Anyways, her house was swept away, family thing, and ended it. The next day, in a drunken stupor, she was on all fours digging for the family jewels and where the house was, and in a pathetic scene. But that hurricane. That was a Cat 3. By the way, this tornado, they estimate to be an F2, maybe an F3. But that was a Category 3, and it affected 2 countries, 13 states. The timber that was knocked down, 2 billion trees knocked down in New England. There was a great fire in New London. This is one of my signature lectures, The Great Hurricane of 1938. That's what I'm drawing from. But the people that experienced it, although I don't believe that you were around in 1938, but if you're going to tell me you are, I will. Okay, you look a little young for me.
12 years old.
Okay.
But all I remember, there were 2 gigantic, tallest trees that you could imagine, like a 3-story house, and they came crashing down, and that's the first we realized something was going on.
Yep.
And my brothers were out all over, you know, playing baseball or whatever, so it was a sort of scary time.
Yeah, and that happened right after school. Yes. Wow.
When the storm subsided, it was far out, you know, 5 miles or more out. But, you know, you live in this type of weather and you have to expect it.
Right. Especially in the Keys.
In the Keys, you get them all the time.
Right. In the Caribbean.
Caribbean.
I often say if I study sunspots, not to make a big deal out of this, but the weather aberrations. In 1492, when Columbus came west during hurricane season,
yes.
They were still in what was known as the Little Ice Age, and in a period known as the Maunder Minimum of lack of sunspots. But He was lucky. I often tell people we could have Viking ancestors here if it weren't for Columbus. Might have been delayed by 100 years. But that area, notorious for hurricanes. I've studied 16th century hurricanes that took place right in the area throughout the 1500s down there. But you're right, in the Midwest you're going to get your tornadoes. You're going to get your hurricanes in the Florida coast. Now the Gulf Coast seems that they veer into the Gulf of Mexico.
Because I came home in one of the years, and didn't we have a hurricane?
Well, there was Belle in 76, a tropical storm. Okay. Storm, and I remember I was delivering papers that day, and I was riding into the wind. I was going backwards, and don't tell anybody I ditched the papers that day and went to the donut shop.
Two was all hung up with cars that couldn't go anywhere.
Right,
The storm, and the police came to my house because I had an empty house, and I put up 7 people for 3 days.
Wow. Taping your windows, by the way, does not prevent glass from shattering. It's a myth. The other hurricane was Hurricane Gloria, I believe, in 85. And then Hurricane Bob in August of 91. And I saw the devastation that left. And that's a tropical storm, a tropical depression. Not even a storm. And it looked like F-16s took out Wareham, Cape Cod Canal, leveled it. So we're vulnerable. And I hearken back to your comment. If you look at the great hurricanes in New England, you have the Great Colonial Hurricane of 1635, where the storm surge forced Indians into their trees. There was destruction of Plymouth. Then you have the Great September Gale of 1815, which water rose 12 feet in Providence, Rhode Island. There was a water spout reported on the Charles River. And then you have the Great Hurricane in 1938. I also like to throw in 1869, Saxby's Gale, it's called, which is also a devastating hurricane. But we haven't been hit, and I try to tell people with hurricanes, if you're a clown, you'll drown. And scientific studies have shown that a gallon of milk and a loaf of bread are not your best defense against any storm. You know, only it happens to a bunch of shore cows. Yes?
Just to follow your thought, because I'm amazed how many people don't know this, I have an aged dad who lives in a vulnerable community, and I'm taking care of property for another vulnerable community. So I've been a great student of this in the last decade.
Do you mind saying what area? The vulnerable communities?
Westport, and my dad's now staying over here. Westport, Mass.
Devastated during Jeeves.
1938, which, as you pointed out, took out trees all the way to Quebec in the billions, killed people through flash flooding all the way into northern New England. It was a world-changing storm. I mean, the before and after pictures are very impressive. The account of the people in Westport Harbor where the storm surge was 18 feet or something. There's a pamphlet written by somebody. I gave it to a friend who moved to the area. I said, do read this at bedtime. It'll scare the shit out of you. And you need to be that scared in the location that this family is now living.
Oh, absolutely.
But here's what I was going to just finish up your thought. If you look at these, and they've charted quite a few of them because they now can chart prehistoric storms through pollen analysis and stuff. So there's a lot of, you know, record beyond back to, you know, the 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely typical is what Danny did. It wibble wobbles in the Caribbean or off of Florida, and then it kind of wibble wobbles up at Charleston or Savannah. Once you're past Cape Hatteras, it is here in 6 to 12 hours. If your plan is not in your mind ahead of time, and any supplies you need ahead of time, and any travel you need to do ahead of time, you are too late. And these things can kill. So people need to be taking this much more seriously. And Danny, they were changing the course of that up to the last day. And at one point, they had the possible tracks going to the west of us, which puts you in a world more trouble because of the direction of the storm. And you mentioned 1938 as a Category 3. When we hear these weather reports about the storms in the Gulf of Mexico, they're going, oh, hell, it's only a Category 4. And a Category 3, they'd be going, happy day. 1938 was moving, as you said, what, 67 miles an hour?
Yeah, I want to show you.
You had the Category 3 to the 67 miles an hour, which they don't mention this on these little weather reports, and you have got very, very frightening wind speeds because of the combined number.
Inhuman.
And that storm went just to the west of us here in Westport and Boston, which is why Watch Hill, it was to the west of Watch Hill where there was great loss of life. Unbelievably dangerous storm. And the other thing is, you mentioned the in your storm that you were discussing, the tide raising in Rockport. As the storm is going over, it has very, very low pressure. So it's actually lifting the ocean. So you can have, you know, a storm surge from something like a tsunami earthquake where there's actually a physical pushing of the water. But when you have very, very low pressure, the ocean is actually being lifted. Not the wave, the whole
yeah,
ocean.
Right, right, right.
And when they were saying in Katrina, oh, good news, it's going over like Pontchartrain. I'm going, what, are you crazy?
Yeah,
and
right.
That's the most disastrous. It would have been better if it had gone right over the city, because when it went over Pontchartrain, it lifted the whole Gulf and all of Lake Pontchartrain because of the low pressure.
And the buffoons still think they can hold off a hurricane bolstering up the levees.
Everything about weather, they always use the word official. Boy, talk about man proposes and God disposes. What makes you think there isn't in the 21st century a Category 6 and a Category 7? I think there probably is.
Wow. Wow.
So, I mean, these things have got to be taken seriously. And even though our numerical risk here is relatively rare over the centuries, like you said, don't be down at the store looking for the bottle of milk.
100 years of 1886 to 1996 of hurricanes. So, I mean, obviously, you know, I was up in Halifax, Nova Scotia, after a hurricane hit there. But Britain and Ireland vulnerable. But, yeah, it just shows how they veer in, slam into Gulf of Mexico. But look, I know what I like studying. You can't see it, but the Baja, Arizona hurricanes. They come right at the Baja. There's a history of hurricanes in Arizona, but it's fascinating. I know I've gone on to another lecture, and Barbara wants me to vamoose, but fascinating stories. I love archaeology, but we know the major hurricanes, and I talked about the Great September Gale of 1815, the Great Colonial Hurricane of 1635, and GH-38. But we know by analyzing sediment that a major hurricane, a Cat 4, struck between the years 1100 and 1150. How cool is that? 1300 to 1400, and 1400 to 1450. And again, that's Saxtes right there. But great strikes of antiquity.
You mentioned the flooding of Providence in Providence, Rhode Island, right?
Yes.
In 1850 to 1938, downtown Providence was underwater, and it was a little more developed at the time.
Oh, absolutely.
1920 feet, I think.
Yeah, there's a story I called Wedding Splashers instead of Wedding Crashers, where a couple was getting married. It was in the Society pages. They went on with the wedding. One family got stranded in the railroad station. People that were put up there came up to the third floor, and they ate all the food and drank all the wine by the time the groom showed up. But
I was empty.
Yeah.
You know what it is to put up all these people day and night?
Oh, I can imagine. Thing that wouldn't leave.
Pillows, sleeping without pillows so that you could make a mattress on the living room floor.
Sure. And there must have been one person with no manners. I'm just saying, there's always one. I think the statistical is 1 in 4. You can't wait to leave. But does anybody else have any other comments, questions? Yes, sir.
We recently had water spout off of Barrington last year and the New Hampshire tornado, too.
Yep. The New Hampshire, was that an F1 or F2? And water spout. Was that videotaped off of Barrington?
Yeah, I think so. What was that, last summer?
Yeah,
2008. Yeah.
Yeah,
I think it was associated with the July 2nd hail.
I think there was two in the area, but there was one on the TV, right?
Yeah.
And the summer before, there was that significant hailstones, to the north and south of here, and then that touchdown is some pretty significant water spouts just off Marble Head, and in fact, if it had touched down a mile or two sooner, I think there would have been loss of life. It was a little too close.
You struck on something when you said Cat 6 and Cat 7, off the scale type tornadoes. Now, I know that tornadic activity this year nationally was down. I don't know the exact figures, but I remember hearing reference that it was down in other years. And I was talking with some folks before the lecture today about the sunlight. You hear the global warming argument, and you hear, oh, it's nature. And the global warming advocates will twist the data somewhat, as if we're going to drown. Like where I'm living in Watertown, will be washed out. It will be in 10,000 years. And then you have the people that say it's natural. Well, if you start looking at the data, I'm studying sunspots, and I have been doing that for a few years, but also something known as global dimming or solar dimming. And in a nutshell, there was a scientific quest underway in the United States in September of 2001. There were measuring the irradiance, the sun's irradiance, the sunlight hitting the earth, and the evaporation rates of water. And they noticed this trending was downward. Well, when they halted the flights from September 12th to the 14th, they noticed a 12% increase in sunlight irradiance and a 20% increase in evaporation rates. So my theory is, and again, is that enjoy global warming, the halcyon days of double harvest, large fruits, because global warming, in my opinion, this is my opinion only, is a precursor to what? Global cooling. And let me tell you, when you get to the global cooling ball game, and what happens is it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. When people can't afford the fossil fuels or whatever, they start using their fireplaces. And there are three times as many commercial flights in the air today than there were in 1989, some with as low as 6 or 7 people on them going cross-country. And then you have 4 times as many automobiles on the road than in 1970. So anybody that tells you it's natural, stop. Okay, Mr. Cheney's not in office anymore. You can tell the truth. There's no need for you to twist that data. It's not. There's pollution being emitted. And what I tell little kids is reducing your own carbon footprint and recycling. But if that ball of fun gets blocked out, you're all done. And maybe Mother Nature will shake us off like a bad case of the fleas, because when Earth becomes too warm, Mother Nature tends to set off her volcanoes. And again, I hearken back to the year without a summer, 1816, where you had 4 volcanic eruptions from the years 1812 to 1814. And on April 10th and 11th, 1815, the volcano of Tambora went off in Indonesia. It took about a year for the ash, aerosol, and gas to go around the world. Ruined the harvest in New England. Temperatures dropped worldwide by a degree, which is catastrophic. It snowed on Boston Common on June 7th, 1816. There were ice flows in the Gulf of Mexico. There was 3-foot snowdrifts in northern Vermont and in Quebec. You saw aberrational weather, and that was due, well, it was attributed to 3 factors. Number one is volcanic eruptions. You had some mini volcanic eruptions, then you had the largest in 1600 years, which was Tambora, made 4 times as large as Krakatoa of 1883. And then you had a minimum of sunspot activity. And Don Kent, do you remember him? One time told me as a child, I said, I was interested in weather. He said, look to the sun, don't look to the sky in terms of weather. He was studying sunspots. And studying the graph, you had 2 minimums of sunspots basically within what's known as the Little Ice Age, which ballpark 1400 to 1850. But you had the Dalton minimum and the Maunder minimum. And this is where the sun was blank. And usually when the sun is blank, it's dimmer. Ironically, when there's magnetic activity in the sun, it's actually brighter, the sun, more so sunlight. Right now, 2009 is the blankest year. We've just surpassed 300 days of blank days of sunspots, the blankest year in the space age. But I hearken back, it blew away 1954. So I have to look back in the records. I want to say 1902 or 1903, and we should break that record. 2 back-to-back blank years, 2008, 2009. We're waiting for what's known as solar cycle 24 to begin. Solar cycles last about 11 years, and it hasn't begun. And what I try to tell people is once that sun starts firing off those solar flares, and again, you're going to see some danger in the Earth. 1859, for instance, Carrington super solar flare. September 1st, 1859, Richard Carrington, British astronomer, looking at the sun. I don't recommend doing that through filters. Notice a huge prominence that covered 15% of the sun's surface. Huge. The next day, bright auroras seen all the way down to the equator. Aurora are usually polar phenomena. That geomagnetic storm hit the Earth. It fried telegraph wires. Telegraph operators, some were electrocuted. Some had burnt the telegraph paper. Some were jolted off, and they were still carrying messages, even though it was burnt out. Messages were carried around, ghost telegraph messages were carried around for the next 2 or 3 days, kind of like that Queen Mary signal that you've heard bouncing around the ionosphere. So that was 1859. There was another great solar flare in 1961, not as large as the 1859, but in 2001 and in 2003, I want to call it an X-23, the Chandra Observatory, this massive, massive solar flare in October 2003, and again, previously in March of that year, sun was erupting, and we just happened to miss it. The Earth happened to be, the solar wind blew it away from us. But if that had hit the Earth, would have cooked every satellite, we'd all be in the dark here. You'd be trying to text, you couldn't text. almost like an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse event. So when I see right now we're about to come out of this solar minimum, okay, and solar cycle 24 will begin. And when that happens, and the flares, you're going to see an aberration in the weather. More violent weather, quick swing as the atmosphere adjusts to the new solar climate. But I always watch those volcanoes. And if you put those two together, we're in trouble. Because right now, and you're going to see the numbers probably in about a month or so, they're trying to, we've had a nice month of September here in New England, but you're going to see harvest down. I'm willing to say maybe up to 20% less in bounty of harvest. So there can people tell it's natural. Others will tell you it's global warming. I like to look at data from 100, 100, 500, and 1,000 years out and looking at the mass. And right now we're in a critical period in solar astronomy. Very critical period. It's just not good to have 301 or 302 maybe, I haven't checked the website, of blank solar days. And it directly impacts the weather. Scary stuff. So.
But we don't live at the foot of Mount Rainier, where when it blows, it's going to have such a melt of ice and mud that they're all going to die. And we don't live in the New Madrid earthquake region, which is about a quarter of the country.
Right. New Madrid happened in 1811, altered the course of the Mississippi River. It did not ring church bells in Boston. Well, now you're on to another lecture, but I'll just quickly talk about New England earthquakes. If you look at the great New England earthquakes measured by Anglo-Saxons, there were 1638. That was felt all the way into the interior. Native Americans claim that they felt that. There was one in Brockton in 1697. Major earthquake off of Cape Ann in 1744. The biggest one was 1755, where ships coming in saw dead fish on the surface. There was almost electromagnetic activity on the surface of the water. Those are the major, something I call the Boston Shaker, I believe, was 1802. But since then, we had some in the 1940s, and you're talking on the Richter 3.5 max or below. And Back Bay, which Beacon Hill was chopped off, and they threw the dirt in Back Bay, then Boston burned in October of 1872, and we took all those remains and built on top of it. So different parts of Boston would feel a different amplitude of an earthquake, of a temblor shaking. But to say that we're the big one's going to happen, Dr. John Ebel from Weston Observatory, Boston College, told me that the earthquakes of 500 years ago are the earthquakes of 500 years from now. Okay, in other words, if there were active seismic events 500 years ago, they're generally in the La Mombaise area of Quebec, up near St. Lawrence, near Three Rivers. That's an area, active area. Of course, you said Littleton, did you say? Right, Littleton, Mass, in Connecticut, Moody's. Known as the Moody's noises, you can hear the earth shift beneath you. New England's an active region, but we're not going to get the big one. Tell you what, the big one's going to come in an arc like from China or Russia. That's the big one, and it's not going to be any with seismic activity. And in terms of the San Andreas Fault, you made the comment, if you live in the area, you've got to deal with it. And if you're built right on the fault or you're in the Bay Area, you're staring down the barrel of a gun.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, thank you very much for coming out. I know I strayed and I'm scattered, but thank you.